Hi, hey, Remy here. This is For the Record program number 1352. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 26. This is being recorded on October 12th of the year 2024. And before we plunge right back in and unpack some of Monty's brilliant research, I want to remind people that the new 64-gigabyte flash drive, we've moved too much material to fit it on the 32 gigabytes, and keep your turn your mic back on when you're ready to do this. But the new 64-gigabyte flash drive is available. It will contain not only all of the programs I've done with Monty, all of my work on the genesis of COVID, my entire life's work, plus a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. That is, well, basically, there is a link on the recent descriptions. That is available. The flash drive itself probably won't be assembled for a little while, so it will get caught up. But you can order that now. And I want to stress again that neither myself nor Monty gets any money whatsoever from this. Perhaps prove positive that my worst critics' assessments of me are correct and that I'm nuts, and this is my entire life's work, and I get no money whatsoever from it. That having been said, I want to reintroduce to the audience, with great pleasure and honor, my new co-host, Monty. Monty, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave. Happy to be here.
Now, we have been unpacking chapter 3 of a book which is as important a book as has ever been written. That is Gold Warriors, The Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. It really appears that the Seagraves paid with their lives for writing and publishing this book. So the least we can do is to disseminate the information. Without understanding the information in that book, I don't think people can understand the post-World War II economic and political landscape. And one aspect of this, that very important book is to understand the reality of what took place in China. And we've been talking about the Green Gang of Shanghai and Du Yuexing, or Tu Yuexing, also known as Big Ear Tu, who was the real governor of the Kuomintang and the narco-fascist government of Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek was his subordinate. And it should be understood that the Green Gang got effective control of the Wampo Military Academy, that's spelled W-H-A-M-P-O-A. That was the Chinese equivalent of West Point. And all of the senior officers in the nationalist Chinese military, or the Kuomintang military, were, in addition to being officers in the military, they were operatives of the Green Gang in Shanghai. So with that introduction, Monty, if you would begin again with Chapter 3 of Gold Warriors, the softcover edition published by Verso, and read to us about Big Ear Tu, or Tu Yuexing, and his little puppy dog, Chiang Kai-shek.
Right. So reading again, this is from Chapter 3 of the book, entitled Rape of China. You'll find us on page 34, 35, and 36, passages I'll be reading from. In Chapter 3 of the paperback version of Gold Warriors by the Seagraves. Reading again, quote, if there was a single genius behind the Underworld Alliance, it was General Dohihara. Spelling on that name again is D-O-I-H-A-R-A. The mastermind of Manchurian drug trade, whose personal circle included Japan's top gangsters. He was on a first-name term with leaders of China's Green Gang based in Shanghai. Above ground, Shanghai was administered by three governments. The biggest was the Chinese municipality, run by the Kuomintang regime of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. Next were two prosperous foreign enclaves, concessions squeezed from the Manchu throne of the 19th century. The smaller was a French concession with a population of around 500,000 people. To say it was French is an exaggeration, as there were only about 2,400 French civilians and 300 French gendarmes. The rest were 14,000 Europeans of various nationalities, including white Russians and Chinese, who preferred French rule to Chinese tyranny. The French concession was home to China's most powerful godfather, Tu Yu Sheng. Spelling on that is T-U-Y-U-E-H hyphen S-H-E-N-G. Tu Yu Sheng, the boss of the Green Gang. He enjoyed French protection in return for generous contributions from rackets and drugs, brothels, and gambling. Beyond the French concession was the international settlement, dominated by Britain and, to a lesser extent, America, meaning the United States. Its foreign population was less than 40,000. In China as a whole, Britain's influence was preeminent, and her government citizens had nearly $1 billion invested there, most of it in Shanghai. By the 1920s, however, the largest single foreign community in Shanghai was Japan, mostly businessmen, bankers, hoteliers, gangsters, and secret agents. Hostile towards Westerners and the Chinese, the Japanese inhabited a little district called Little Tokyo and the suburb of Hongkou. Many of them were advance agents for the invasion of China by the Japanese. Japan had been preparing feverishly using industrial cover. I want to make a small editorial here, Dave, if I may.
Absolutely.
It should be noted that the way that the Japanese set up their industrial cover apparatus is, well, how should I word this properly so I can get the chronology right? What the CIA did in the 1950s with their international organizations divisions, setting up an industrial cover apparatus for their agents in a stay-behind capacity, meaning the Gladio capacity in the 1950s and 60s, that is an exact copy of what Japanese intelligence did in China. Okay? So the industrial cover apparatus that the Japanese staged in Shanghai in the late 1920s and the early 1930s, okay, was in fact the exact same thing that Alan Dulles and his CIA would do to set up their Gladio apparatus, okay? It was all done under industrial cover. So continuing with the Seagraves, quote, all over East and Southeast Asia, military projects were underway, including airfields, port facilities, and coastal surveys. Right into the heart of Shanghai's riverfront, Japanese companies bought three large wharves and dug a tunnel from those warehouses to reinforce concrete Japanese Army headquarters and arsenal on the Jingguang Road. Little was done in Shanghai without the knowledge of Boss Tu, who took a bite of every pastry. Businessmen who refused to pay off Tu risked being kidnapped or being shot or having their houses bombed. Once Tu abducted Mei Lei Sung, the bride of Chiang Kai-shek, to remind the generalissimo who was really in charge. By 1932, the 44-year-old Boss Tu had already made a great fortune. He was a self-made man with a vengeance, born in desperate poverty across the river in Putong, in squalid some called Kayo Chayao, with his father, a coolie, in a grain shop. From his teens, Boss Tu became a runner for the drug lord of the French concession, a chief detective known as Pak Mark Huang. At the time, there were three gangs, the red, green, and blue, competing for control of the drug trade. Tu showed Pak Mark Huang how they could together work as a cartel. Eventually, the red and blue gangs withered, leaving Tu's green gang in charge of all rackets far up the Yangtze River into China's interior. By the 1930s, gambling was on the greater scale in Shanghai than anywhere else on earth, with proceeds of more than $1 million a week. Tu's three-story Fengxin Casino on Avenue Fox provided customers with chauffeured limousines. There was dog racing at Tu's Conidrome. Over 100,000 prostitutes worked in brothels, cabarets and dance halls like Farron's and Del Monte's, where white Russian women danced and did more with paying clients. Once they understood each other, Du became one of Chiang Kai-shek's chief backers. So once again, as a small editorial note, Dave, I'd like to point out that Jean Gollet and George de Morneschild, so that would be George de Morneschild and his third wife, were citizens of Shanghai as a part of a white Russian community in the late 20s and the 1930s. So it's fascinating, the political intrigue that's happening in Shanghai in this time period.
And by the way, very quickly, for the benefit of listeners, not familiar with him, George de Morneschild was one of Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence babysitters. His uncle, Baron Hugo Maybell, was in charge of all Abwehr, that is German military intelligence activities in North America at one point. His brother, who, correct me if I'm wrong, I think his name was Dmitry Morneschild.
Dmitry von Morneschild. And not only was he one of the founding members of Radio Free Europe, he sat on ABCOMLIB, the American Committee for the Liberation of Bolshevism, which was the parent CIA front company, not only for Radio Free Europe, but for various elements of the Gladio program through something called the Crusade for Freedom. Okay, so Dmitry von Morneschild is that man's name.
And they also were very tight with the Bouvier clan, of whom Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy, from which Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy came. Go ahead, Marty, continue, please.
And the only reason why I point that out, Dave, is because George de Morneschild was identified in CIA documents from 1973 as being a full-fledged Vichy intelligence agent. And even though I don't have the document in front of me, it should be noted that that report was actually penned, meaning it was written by Richard Helms, okay?
Go ahead. Go ahead. Please continue, because I could go on about Mrs. Helms' baby boy, Dick. Go ahead.
So it has to be appreciated that the Morneschild was identified as a Vichy intelligence agent living in the French Quarter of Shanghai under the protection of Du Yusheng in 1929. That's fascinating to know. So continuing. Reading again from Chapter 3 of the Seagrave's book, Gold Warriors. This is page 35 of the paperback. Reading again. Once they understood each other, Tu became one of Chiang Kai-shek's chief backers. He shared drug profits directly with the Generalissimo, and in return was licensed by the Kuomintang government. This allowed Chiang to pretend that he was pursuing an aggressive campaign of opium suppression. But only Tu's rivals were suppressed. The Opium Suppression Bureau turned over confiscated opium to the Green Gang for conversion to heroin and morphine. The Generalissimo received his cut through the Farmers Bank of China, owned by Tu and referenced to sarcastically as the Opium Farmers Bank. Chiang used his cut to upgrade his personal family, to upgrade his army, which annoyed Tokyo. During the initial Japanese assault in Shanghai in 1932, Boss Tu sent the Green Gang Tufts to fight the invaders. Chiang praised him for his gallant display of patriotism, but it was only turf warfare. Tu was not prepared to let the Japanese undermine his control of gambling, prostitution, and narcotics. Therefore, General Dohihara worked out a compromise by which the Green Gang, the Kuomintang regime, and the Japanese secretly divided the spoils, much as the Blue, Red, and Green Gangs had done earlier. The deal was implemented by the Ku brothers, one of whom was the Green Gang's boss in Shanghai waterfront, while the other was a general in the Kuomintang. This enabled the Kempeitai, spelling on that is K-E-M-P-E-I-T-A-I. Reading again, this enabled the Kempeitai to open its first Shanghai brothel in 1932, while Japanese investors started cotton mills, ironworks, railways, paper mills, power plants, and banks. Where once British shipping had dominated, Japanese steamships linked the Yangtze River ports deep into the interior, ready to be converted into troop carriers. Now, I want to end the references to the Seagrave's book on that note, simply because it demonstrates that the entire Japanese effort in China, okay, and I want to make that very clear to your listening audience, the entire Japanese war effort, including the way they invaded China, their troop carriers, was a massive narco-terror supply line. That is how the Japanese invaded and occupied Manchuria. Every single front entity and every single company, every single bank, every single shipping line, cotton mill, ironwork, railway, paper mill, everything, the power plants that the Japanese established in occupied China during the Second World War was financed through a narco-terror supply line with Chiang Kai-shek and Du Yusheng as the commanders of it, taking equal cuts, equal concessions in the Japanese occupied forces. So on that note, it is very difficult to separate the specter. In fact, I would argue, Dave, and you're going to have to call me out on this, please correct me if I'm wrong in my assessment, I would have to suspect that when Kojiro Kitamura, as director of the Japanese Bank of International Settlements and as a representative of the Yokohama Species Bank, bear in mind, he was also a former financial attaché to the Japanese military intelligence forces in Berlin. I would have to assume that Kojiro Kitayama, when he is in contact with Pierre Jacobson and Alan Dulles in July of 1945, this is the economic concession that he is protecting, a gargantuan narco-terror supply line. That is what he is protecting in Formosa when he is speaking with Alan Dulles in July of 1945. Am I wrong to assume that, Dave?
I don't think you're wrong. I would add that I think one could perhaps volley out a bit, and the entire Japanese effort on mainland Asia. Japan is obviously an island country, but this includes Korea, the territories they occupied during World War II. It is inextricably linked with activities that we would classify as criminal, not only outright looting, but drug trafficking. So I think the assessment is accurate on your part. However, I also think that one should, in a sense, dolly the camera back and take a longer, more expansive view of that. One of the things that the Seagraves point out in Gold Warriors, and something that I unpacked at some length and for the record 1141, and there are links to this, to that aforementioned program in both 1345 and 1346 and 1349 and 1350, and there will be in this one as well. Japan looted Korea, which was a very wealthy and sophisticated country, over a period of centuries. And at one point, Korea was actually a protectorate of China. And, so that, yes, I think what you're saying is accurate. I think that, again, one should dolly the camera out. And in addition to focusing on the scene in China, in Shanghai, vis-a-vis narcotics, the collaboration between the Chinese under, quote, underworld, which is really the overwhelm of Chiang Kai-shek's, again, narco-fascist Kuomintang. It includes not only all of Japanese occupied Asia, but it can be seen in a centuries long, time frame. Go ahead, please, Marty.
Well, in the dollying out, we have the dolly out. We mentioned the dolly out in the previous program, and that dolly out is Brigadier General, Akamoto, who, of course, was the chief. He is identified not only by Alan Dulles and Pierre Jacobson, but by the deputy commander of the OSS, Charles S. Cheston, and the commander of the OSS, William Donovan. They all characterize General Okamoto as being the chief of Japanese military intelligence in Nazi-occupied Europe. And bear in mind, Okamata, from 1943 to 1944, right before he took up a post as the Japanese military attaché in Bern, Switzerland, it has to be appreciated that Okamata was the commander of all Southern Army command for the Japanese in the occupied territories, which means that Okamata oversaw, right before he became the military intelligence attaché in Bern, Switzerland, in 1944 and 45. Okamata was the commander of all occupied military forces for Taiwan, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Korea. He was the occupied commander in Malaysia. He oversaw all of the occupied forces in Thailand. He was the occupied commander for all of the islands in the Pacific. Everything south of, physically south of Japan, meaning the mainland islands, was under the command of Okamata. So, we have to appreciate we have to appreciate that the man that oversaw all of these activities that you're referencing to, he is present in these meetings with Alan Dulles.
Absolutely. No, I think you've got that. I think you've nailed it. I think that's absolutely correct. I think perhaps the consideration is a semantic one, but yes.
Sure.
Also I want to remind the audience, that in a sense, when you are unpacking your research for us, I, to a considerable extent, consider myself a student of what you're doing. So, if some of these you're talking about are incompletely or perhaps even past some point incorrectly understood by me, it's because I am learning along with you. Yes, absolutely. And I'm hoping that the audience is appreciating the extent to which they have been lied to systematically and institutionally about what happened, not only in World War II, but about what's happening today. This, what we're looking at is not only, quote, globalization, unquote, but we're looking at the real history of World War II, which is inextricably linked with fascism. You can't talk about fascism without talking about the most powerful economic, financial, and or industrial, financial, and political dynamics of our time. And that's what we're doing here. Please continue, Mavi.
So reading about General Kaitoyomi Okamata and his activities as the occupation commander, I'd like to read once again a short blurb from Gold Warriors. This is, once again, still, we're in chapter 3 of the book, Rape of China. Paperback version, we'll find this on page 36. So, talking about what exactly was General Okamata commander of as the chief of Southern Army forces for the occupation of Japan, I'm going to read what exactly was happening specifically in Manchuria, Korea, and Thailand, leading up to the events of the United States entering the Second World War. So, quote, this is from page 36 of Gold Warriors, paperback edition, chapter 3, Rape of China, quote, in violation of the deal, Japan began to subvert the Kuomintang opium monopoly by bringing in larger and larger quantities of drugs. What better way to demoralize China than by flooding it with cheap drugs from Manchuria, including heroin tablets and cigarettes laced with heroin? This caused dismay and consternation in the Kuomintang and the Green Gang circles. The Japanese were growing opium on an unprecedented scale in Manchuria, supplementing it from opium imported from ships from Iran. The paste was converted into morphine and heroin at factories in Manchuria, Korea, and Taiwan, then smuggled directly across the strait on motorized junks to mainland warehouses owned by the Mitsu Trust, the Mitsubishi Trust, and other conglomerates.
I think that would be pronounced, one more, I think that's Mitsui, M-I-T-S-U-I, is that correct?
Correct. The Mitsui Trust.
The Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, and Yasuda are the primary Zaibatsu in Japan. Those are the giant family-owned trusts, and those in turn are inextricably linked with, again, I just posted to my Patreon channel an article, what did Yoko Ono's father do in World War II? He worked for those and with those elements. Please go ahead, Nobby.
So, an army factory in Seoul, Korea, produced over 2,600 kilos of heroin between 1938 and 1939, was only one of several hundred factories in Manchuria, Korea, Taiwan, and in Japanese concessions in mainland cities like Hankou. At its peak, more than 1,000 Japanese firms and concessions were manufacturing and selling drugs, including cocaine and amphetamines, end quote. So, as a representative of the military attaché, and as the Japanese military intelligence attaché in Bern, meeting with Alan Dulles and Pierre Jacobson, who was an economic advisor to the Bank of International Settlements, and Kojiro Kitamura, director of the Bank of International Settlements for the Japanese, and a representative of Yokohama Species Bank, we have the specter of Japanese business and what it represented in Formosa, Thailand, what it represented in Korea, and what it represented ultimately in mainland China at the end of the Second World War. 1,000, I'll read that again from the Seagrave's book, 1,000 factories, mostly represented by Mitsubishi Trust and what was the other one, Dave? I'm sorry for the pronunciation on that.
Mitsui, M-I-T-S-U-I.
Mitsui, the Mitsui Trust and the Mitsubishi Trust primarily, through 1,000 factories spread across these three countries, were producing thousands of kilograms of heroin every year. So, 1,000 times 1,000, and you get an idea of the sheer bulk of, the sheer tonnage, I should say, of heroin and cocaine and amphetamines that are being produced by the Japanese occupation forces through their industrial intelligence activities. Okay? And this is all through Japanese military intelligence in the occupied forces, which is represented here in the secret surrender deal with Alan Dulles through General Akamoto. I mean, this is the reality of the secret surrender deal between Alan Dulles and Japanese intelligence in July of 1945. So now I'd like to pivot back directly to the Department of the State Office of the Historian Foreign Relations documents that reference these surrender deals, if I may, Dave. Now that we've presented what exactly is at play here economically between Alan Dulles and the BIS and, of course, Yokohama Species Bank's representatives, if I may continue.
Absolutely. Now, this is from the interagency working group, is it, on Nazi war crimes from the 1990s was when this these documents were compiled, correct?
Yeah, ultimately not published in 2018, though.
That's so they only waited, 20-plus years to do it, Dad.
Right. So this is the Foreign Relations of the United States Diplomatic Papers, 1945, British Commonwealth, the Far East, Volume 6, page 489, from the Office of the Historian, the Department of the State Interagency Working Group, Nazi War Crimes Disclosure. Reading again, quote, Pierre Jacobson reports that between 10 and 13 July, he had a series of conferences with Yoshimura, a Japanese official attached to the Bank of International Settlements, and Kojiro Kitamura, a director of the bank representative of Yokohama Species Bank and a former financial attaché in Berlin to Japanese intelligence. Yoshimura and Kitamura claim to be acting in consultation with Japanese minister to Switzerland. Once again, that minister's last name is spelled K-A-S-E, Kase, and Brigadier General Okamoto, former Japanese military attaché in Bern, who is now believed to be chief of Japanese intelligence in Nazi-occupied Europe. Yoshimura and Kitamura claim further that Kase, once again, that's the foreign minister representing Minister Togo, who in turn represented Hideki Tojo, and Akamura, Akamoto, who, of course, is the former chief of the Southern Army Command and effectively General, Akamoto was effectively Rear Admiral Yoshio Kadama's superior officer within Japanese military intelligence in this time period. Have direct, and once again, I'm reading it directly from the documents. Kase and Akamoto have direct and secret means of communicating with the Japanese Army Chief of Staff. Once again, that's Japanese Chief of Staff General Yoshijiro Amunzu, who is the chief of all army operations in 1945 for the Japanese. Yoshimura also claims that the peace group, which he represents, includes General Emuze, the chief of army chief of staff, General Yoane, who is the chief of minister of the Navy, and Minister Togo, who's the foreign minister for Hideki Tojo. So, reading again from this document, this is Yoshimura and Tetamura appeared to Per Jacobson to no longer question the principle of unconditional surrender, though at one point they asked whether unconditional military and naval surrender might not be sufficient. Once again, we know that that happened. The self-defense force was created, and for almost a solid decade, a general by the name of Charles Andrew Willoughby oversaw the occupation and military intelligence forces in Japan after World War II. As an editorial note, I'd like to remind the listeners that General Akamoto, the military intelligence attaché that I keep on referencing, and effectively Admiral Yoshio Kadama's superior officer, he committed suicide shortly after these proceedings, okay? He took a pistol to his head and shot himself. So Akamoto effectively is not involved in these operations after World War II because Kodama picked up where he left off. So reading again. Both Japanese officials have raised the question, that's Yoshimura and Kitamura, both Japanese officials have raised the question of maintaining Japanese territorial integrity to include Manchukuo, Korea, and Formosa. And as we read from the Seagrave's account, what is the main Japanese import-export for their industrial intelligence? Dave, please, what is it?
Dope.
It's dope. It's narcotics. That's what they're protecting here.
It is. And, you know, just a very quick.
That is exactly what these two bankers for the Bank of International Settlements and Yokohama Species Bank, Yoshimura and Kitamura, are protecting with Alan Dulles and Pierre Jacobson. It's the narcotics concessions in those countries. But please, if you're not stable.
And, you know, the way that the narcotics trade and the people involved in it are portrayed in our culture, in our mass media, mass media, but it's portrayed as an outlying event or phenomenon, you know, the people go, well, they're criminals, you know, they just, you know, ooh, icky poo, you know, and instead, the forces involved in trafficking these materials, profiting from them, are at one with the most powerful forces in our society. I'm reminded of an item from the brilliant Henry Kruger's The Great Heroin Coup, and he notes that as a lawyer for PepsiCo, Richard Nixon was lobbying very heavily for the creation or for the construction of a Pepsi-Cola bottling plant in China. He lobbied successfully. It was built. It never bottled a single bottle of Pepsi-Cola. Instead, it became the largest heroin refinery in Southeast Asia. So, yes, absolutely. One could not exaggerate the importance of narcotics for the global economy. And beyond that, one of the things that I think was so important, as I said before, about Chiang Kai-shek and his narco-fascist Kuomintang, is that they really developed, they've been introduced before, but they really developed, refined, and honed the use of narcotics as a weapon, both to subjugate domestic populations and to subvert foreign populations as well. So yes, absolutely.
If I may, Dave, because we've mentioned Korea several times, and certainly the Seagraves identify Korea as an epicenter for the movement of Iranian and Turkish heroin that is being brought into mainland China through what is now modern day North Korea by Japanese intelligence. I'd like to bring the audience's attention just as a short editorial blurb to the very first commander of the Korean CIA, the KCIA, a man by the name of Jong Pil Kim, last name spelled K-I-M, and what exactly he was doing in 1936 while the entirety of the Korean mainland was being turned into a gargantuan narco-terror supply line between Iran and Japan, if I may.
Yeah, absolutely. But let me remind people, too, that that Korea was a Japanese colony and brutally subjugated. Now, the name of that first director of the KCIA, once again, you could spell it out for us, Monty.
That's Kim Jong Pim, last name spelled JONG-PIL, first name KIM. Jong Pil Kim is his name. And the resource I'm reading from real quick is The Darkest Sides of Politics, Part 2, State Terrorism, Weapons of Mass Destruction, Religious Extremism, and Organized Crime by Jeffrey M. Bale.
Professor Bale is a brilliant researcher, and we have not had his work exhibited, that's a long word, but incorporated into our programs to a greater extent. I'm glad you're using that book. And so tell us now, this is the guy who in the post-World War II period is the first director of the Korean CIA. And yet, as I've indicated, there is a fundamental continuity between the Japanese occupation of Asia and its operations and what we are told was the Cold War or in Korea and Vietnam, the hot wars in Europe. So tell us about what that first director of the KCIA was doing in Korea for Japan in 1936.
Well, effectively, he graduated from the Korean Army's Officer Candidate School and immediately was assigned to Military Intelligence G2, where he specialized in counterintelligence in North Korean affairs. That's a direct quote from The Darkest Sides of Politics by Jeffrey Bale. So, ultimately, the Japanese intelligence operations that were absorbed by General Willoughby and ultimately by Alan Dulles through his secret military intelligence concessions, that school that he graduated from, the Korean Army Officer Candidate School, and you have to work me with the pronunciation on this. I believe it's pronounced the Chung Ong province of North Korea, and the spelling on that is CH UNGCH ONG province.
Now this,
in Korea.
This will be one of the unconfused myself here. Now this is what in the post-war period is called North Korea, but if I'm understanding correctly, this is pre-World War II. This is what's going on in Korea. When it was a Japanese colony. So when we talk about him graduating from, moving into G2, that is for the Japanese. Am I understanding you correctly?
Right. And we have to appreciate that, Korean nationalists that sided with the Japanese military intelligence apparatus were considered honorary Japanese, very similar to how Quisling and emigre elements in Nazi Germany, many of their commanders were considered honorary Aryans.
Including General Kim Suk-won, who was in charge of border operations for Syngman Rhee. And in future programs, we'll talk not only about Syngman Rhee's work for the Japanese. He was the first dictator of Korea, and he was a fascist dictator. But also, President Diem's work for the Japanese, and he was the head of the South Vietnamese government as well. But he had previously worked for the Japanese when they occupied Vietnam. Continue.
Right. So ultimately, That's what I just wanted to demonstrate about the, you know, just the sheer audacity of these operations that are being conducted in this time period that we're looking at in July of 1945 with Alan Dulles and Pierre Jacobson. And of course, you know, what can I say? The principal military commanders of Japanese intelligence activities in occupied Europe. I mean, this is simply, once again, a continuity. And I'm sorry to paint it that black and white for your listening audience, but if this sounds cartoonish or comic book even in terms of the plot, this is the reality. I'm sorry to say, to address your listening audience directly, Dave, I'm sorry to say this, but this is the reality. You know, this is the reality of what happened at the end of the Second World War with Japanese intelligence and American feelers, primarily Alan Dulles and his intelligence teams in Switzerland. So I'd like to pivot once again back to the Nazi war crime disclosure documents in the State Department, the same ones I've been referencing throughout the entirety of not only this program, but the previous program. Reading again, that's from the Foreign Relations United States Diplomatic Papers, 1945, the British Commonwealth, the Far East, Volume 6, page 490. And I'll pick up where I left off before I reference the Professor Bale's brilliant material. But throughout discussions with Jacobson, the Japanese official stressed only two points: the preservation of the emperor and the possibility of returning to the constitution promulgated in 1889. Kitamura prepared and presented to Jacobson a memorandum asking him to sound out directly to Alan Dulles his opinion on those two points. And it includes Mr. Dulles's notes. This is Alan Dulles speaking. I feel that these two Japanese are insisting upon the retention of the emperor because they feel that he alone can take effective action with respect to surrender, and that there is some hope of survival must be held out to him in order to gain his support for an unconditional surrender. End quote. Now, I'd like to once again note to your listening audience, this may sound like a comic book villain operating here, but Alan Dulles was real, and I'm reading directly from State Department transcripts. So effectively, we now know, for the sake of continuity and what can I say, the preservation of history, Alan Dulles actually is the point man for the preservation of the imperial concessions at the end of World War II on his own authority. I'll read it again. Alan Dulles, quote, I feel that these two Japanese are insisting on the retention of their emperor because they feel that he alone can take effective action with respect to surrender, and that there is some hope of survival must be held out to him, meaning to the emperor, in order to gain the emperor's support for unconditional surrender. End quote.
I mean, one of the things that I'm coming to realize through what you're presenting to us, Moppy, in the Seagrave's work, John Foster Dulles, who crafted the 1951, quote, peace, unquote, treaty with Japan, basically enabling them to keep everything they stole, and which was used to defeat the lawsuits brought in the late 1990s by American POWs who had been enslaved by the Japanese corporations. John Foster Dulles, who was Alan Dulles's brother and also fellow lawyer at Sullivan and Cromwell, he was acting at worst as a tandem operator with Alan, perhaps even as something of a junior partner, although his is the name that has primarily survived in the archives vis-a-vis Asia. Alan primarily with regard to Europe, but Alan, you know, again, in post-World War II, he is the manager of Thomas Dewey's 1948 campaign. He's then working for covert operations, in charge of covert operations for CIA, and becomes director of CIA in 1953, appointed by Eisenhower. fired by JFK, and then sits on the Warren Commission, which was covering up JFK's assassination. That is a brief illustration of what I have emphasized for the younger members of the audience. If you want to understand the world you're living in, if you want to understand why America's ice cream has turned to fresh fertilizer, so to speak, and this is on the air, understand the JFK assassination and World War II, because they're inextricably linked, and it goes forward to the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the coup that was Watergate, and then Nixon wasn't far enough to the right. So they got rid of him. And 1980, when they eased Jimmy Carter out with the October surprise. Again, America is not a democracy. It had a coup d'etat on November 22nd, 1963. It's not a democracy, and it doesn't have a free press. And what, Monty, you're presenting to us is, again, you're something of a political intellectual auto mechanic, and you've opened up the hood and you're replacing the spark plugs and tuning the engine and adjusting the carburetor. Perhaps then you'll get on a dolly and go under and work on the differential and the transmission. But you're showing us what is really going on with regard to the engines of power that dominate our lives. And one could not exaggerate how those engines of power are, and that's why I read in the beginning of our last program, part of the introduction to the books for download, that is why we're doing this. It is so important to understand that fascism is not an aberration. It's not separate from the most powerful forces in our society. It is inextricably linked. But beyond that, it's the inevitable, I would say inevitable outgrowth of those. And what you're presenting to us is, again, like a political intellectual auto mechanic. You've opened up the hood and you're tuning the engine and replacing the spark plugs and tuning the carburetor and showing us how the engines of power really operate. So please continue.
Great. I appreciate that. It's very humbling. I'd like to jump once again, from this document inside of the Nazi War Crime Disclosure Act. Well, actually, let me finish up the last two paragraphs, and then I'd like to jump to the phenomena of a man by the name of Joseph Grew, Joseph Clark Grew.
What a piece of for the sack of fresh fertilizer. He's a Morgan protege, and if listeners go to the SpitfireList.com website, they'll find Joseph Grew, that's in G-R-E-W. He is a real piece of fresh fertilizer. We've got about 14, 15 minutes left in this interview, Marty. So, anything that you don't have a chance to unpack, we'll just carry over into our next interview when we next report.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm going to finish up with the transcript of the Dulles' meeting with Katamoto and Yoshimura, once again, respectively representatives of Yokohama Species Bank, and of course the Bank of International Settlements and the Japanese concessions for the Bank of International Settlements. So reading again, quote, later Yoshimura and Kitamura prepared a second memorandum for which they asked how, if Tokyo were ready to proceed, conversations could be arranged with allied representatives and in what form of authorization would be required. Now, I'd like to note once again for the edification of your listening audience, who exactly the two military intelligence attachés were from the American forces that met with the Japanese peace feelers initially, according to, public consumption history. Well, it was a general by the name of Charles Andrew Willoughby, who met in a secret naval air installation called Atsugi. And the chief of security between the peace feelers and the Japanese intelligence forces at Atsugi Air Base in 1945, of course, was also the command pilot for General Willoughby's peace feeler teams that were sent out to accept the surrender deal. That was a major in the United States Army Air Forces by the name of Major Leroy Fletcher Prouty. Okay.
So those
were the two peace feelers that were in effect sent out by American military intelligence in 1945 to meet with the Japanese initially. So once again, just to demonstrate for your listening audience, we're seeing a continuity of interests here. Okay. This isn't happening in a vacuum. What we see with organizations like the World Anti-Communist League, and before that, the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, and the Japanese, Supreme Command Allied Pacific under General Willoughby, and his narco-terror activities in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, with organizations such as the Z Unit, which we've mentioned previously, which was commanded by a lieutenant colonel by the name of Jack Cannon, which is effectively was an American hunter-killer assassination team in the post-World War II Japanese occupied forces. There is a continuity, okay, between what Alan Dulles and Pierre Jacobson are doing here in July of 1945 and eventually what General Willoughby would be doing throughout the entirety of the second half of the 20th century in occupied Japan. And let's face it, the former Japanese occupied territories of Taiwan, Korea, and of course Southeast Asia.
The aforementioned Jack Cannon ran assassination teams in occupied Japan. It's discussed in For the Record 446. Again, accessing material from the brilliant, consummately important Gold Warriors by the Seagraves. But he actually worked with prominent Japanese, including the Katogu, K-A-T-O-H, all capitals. And I think the A, as you mentioned in the Patreon talk, was General Arisu.
General Arisu.
they systematically assassinated elements we would call democratic with a small d, including people who wanted to organize unions, break up some of the large corporations. They were simply liquidated in often brutal and very demonstrative fashions. There was a guy, I think he opposed Japanese policy with regard to the railroads, and they found his dismembered body scattered all over the rail yard someplace. So, yeah, Cannon was a murderer, period.
Oh, 100%. He was a mass murdering psychopath whom I should note, one of his closest associates was a former Chinese intelligence officer that later worked for the Japanese and later the Americans under Cannon's assassination team called the Z Unit. And that man's name was Hong Topong, last name spelled T-O-P-O-H, Hong Topa. And he actually said that Cannon on the weekends would drive around Yokohama in 1946, and he would just drive around in his Jeep with a 45 pistol in his hand and shoot people's house cats from their windows if he could find them. I mean, so that's what he did on his spare time, you know? He shot people's cats, you know, for fun.
He would make childbearing catless women. to reverse a J.D. Vance thing. I mean,
But once again, to give you some idea of Cannon, he killed small animals in his spare time. Yeah, that was a happy weekend for him. Yeah.
For fun. Yeah. Again, it's extremely important to understand these things.
Good note, just for the continuity of what we're talking about here, since you mentioned the Kennedy assassination, inside the Lafitte materials presented by Hank Abarelli in his posthumous release, Coup in Dallas, there's enough evidence, direct evidence, that Jack Cannon was in all likelihood one of the shooters that actually fired shots upon President Kennedy when he entered Dealey Plaza on the 22nd November 1963. So that ought to give you an idea of the levels of sadism and, just sheer brutality that this man harbored in his person. You know, Jack Cannon was a mass murdering psychopath who in all likelihood took part in the firing sequence, the actual firing sequence that murdered President Kennedy on the 22nd November 1963. So returning again to the State Department documents on Yoshimura and Kitamura and Alan Dulles' assessment,
We've got about 8 minutes left in this, so we need to be aware of the time. Go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. So reading again, Peter Jacobson is personally convinced, and once again, this is Alan Dulles speaking, okay? So Peter Jacobson is personally convinced that these approaches are serious and that the Japanese group in Switzerland is consistent with cable contact of Tokyo. Remember in the previous two programs, we talked about a series of conflicting cables that were documented by the State Department talking about, you know, who exactly was initiating this peace deal. And as we know, thanks to the Donovan document, it was not the Japanese that initiated this peace deal. Everything we've been talking about here today in this program was initiated by Alan Dulles. So reading again, Jacobson is personally convinced that these approaches are serious and that the Japanese group in Switzerland is in constant cable contact with Tokyo. This conviction appears to be based on impressions only, since his two Japanese contacts, once again, that's Yoshimura and Kitamura, the BIS and Yokohama Species Bank representatives. This conviction appears to have been based on impressions only, since his two Japanese contacts never stated precisely that they had received instructions from any authorized agency in Tokyo. Ha-ha. Mr. Dulles, in carefully guarded statements, pointed out to Jacobson the following. Quote, once again, this is Alan Dulles speaking. Mr. Gru, now the Gru he's referencing here is Joseph Clark Gru, who, as Undersecretary of State in the 1930s, from 1932 to roughly about 1941, Joseph Gru was the State Department attaché and effectively ambassador to Tokyo, okay, from about 6 June 1932 to roughly about, I believe it was November 14th, 1941, when he relinquished his position.
And he, by the way, endorsed the Japanese occupation of Manchuria in 1931. So go ahead.
Right. Not only, we should note that he endorsed the occupation of Manchuria in 1931 on the concession of the chief of the House of Morgan in China and the chief of concessions for J.P. Morgan Holdings. And effectively, what is now the modern day Citibank, at that time it was known as a Citibank of New York, was a man by the name of Thomas Lamont. And the last name spelling on that is L-A-M-O-T-T. Okay.
It isn't Thomas Lamont, L-A-M-O-N-T, because he was also one of the primary plotters in the 1934 coup attempt in the United States.
That's right. Lamont represented a company called the Guarantee Trust Corporation in the failed 1933-1934 business plot, as it was called, that General Smedley Butler of the United States Marine Corps helped uncover for the Roosevelt administration, the incoming Roosevelt administration. And effectively, Lamont was also, since we're talking about Lamont's background a little bit, between 1921 and 1926, he oversaw combined $240 million loans from the Bank of International Settlements through the National Citibank concessions of the House of Morgan, J.P. Morgan, directly to an Italian banker by the name of Bernardino Nogara, last name spelled N-O-G-A-R-A, who effectively was the Italian representative for the Lateran Treaty. And perhaps you can give your listening audience a quick a blurb as to what the Lateran Treaty was.
Absolutely. Well, I'll give people a reference. The Lateran Treaty was a treaty between the Vatican and Mussolini's fascist government in Italy to basically give international status to the Vatican as a separate nation, and also to coordinate their mutual economic interests. I was going to say Bernardino Nogara. That is a name that resonates with me. I remember him. And there is good discussion of the Lateran Treaty in AFA program number 17. That is one of the five-part series, massive series, done back in 1986 about the shooting of the Pope. That one is in AFA number 17, Fascism and the Vatican. And Bernardino Nogara is very important fellow.
Yeah, effectively, if I were to quantify Bernardino Nogara, if I may interrupt, he was effectively one of the creators of the Vatican Bank, he oversaw the Articles of Confederation and the Lateran Treaty for the creation of Vatican City as a sovereign state. He oversaw the creation of the internal mechanisms of the foreign state, the foreign department of the Vatican State. And by the by the post-World War II environment, Bernardino Nogaro effectively also was overseeing the Articles of Confederation for the creation of a Spanish organization called Opus Dei. So Bernardino Nogara is all over Vatican banking and what can I say? The creation of the current state of the Vatican as a sovereign entity. That's how powerful Nogara was.
Opus Dei is a fascist organization within the Vatican. They might not like my characterization of it, but if you look at this history, that's basically what happens. And I think something like six key members of Francisco Franco's fascist junta in Spain were members of Opus Dei. Opus Dei as well is discussed in the aforementioned AFA 17, Fascism of the Vatican. Mommy, we've got about 2 minutes left here. I'm going to interrupt the discussion here. We'll continue it in our next.
Well, on that note, I just want to say this much. We'll pick up in the next program with Alan Dulles' communications with Joseph Grew and Grew's overseeing of the opium monopoly in mainland China and the post-World War II environment and what that meant for Alan Dulles' fledgling CIA.
So when we could perhaps talk about growing opium poppies in China, but anyway, that's a terrible pun. Please do get the 64 gigabyte flash drive now with all of my life's work on it, plus an easy to download mini library of old anti-fascist books, all of the programs with Monty, all of my programs about the genesis of COVID are on there, and I think our civilization, frankly, is doomed. If you want to know why, well, this discussion, I think, will let you know. And so much of what we're talking about has been portrayed. It has been portrayed at all as peripheral conspiracy theory, not important, minimized, whatever. Oh, no, it is absolutely simple with a capital A and a capital C. And this concludes, for the record, program number 1352, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 26. This is being recorded on October 12th of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.